The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 55. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really enjoy following on Twitter. She is a FinTwit rock star, that is for sure. Her name is Lynn Alden, and I'm super stoked to have her right here, right now. Lynn, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you came out with a report or a blog post the other day that just completely blew my mind. I've interviewed guys like Brent Johnson, Luke Grohman, and they all have a much different view on the dollar. But in this report, you kind of laid out some of the cross currents, which I thought were really, really interesting. Can you kind of go over that report and then let's kind of dive into it?
Sure. Yeah. So I have a couple different reports on the topic, like each one kind of approaching it from a couple different pieces, like different parts of the puzzle. The main crux of it is that there is a global dollar shortage, which right. Both Luke and Brent and others have touched on. And so that consists of a bunch of things. But as the BIS states, it's $12 or $13 trillion in dollar denominated debts outside of the U.S. So in addition to all the dollar debts inside the United States, there's that large shortage, like that large debt outside the United States.
Right. So when you say that there's a dollar shortage, basically it's pretty simple. You've got XYZ company outside the United States that earns their revenue in, let's say, Colombian pesos, and they have a loan for $10 million. Yep. And they need to literally find dollars to service that debt. And if there's a shortage of dollars out there, it just means there's not enough dollars to go around for everyone to pay back their debts. Is that kind of the way it works?
Exactly. And yeah, for many countries, because they borrow in currencies that they can't print. So even at the sovereign level, they can't necessarily bail out their own companies if they also can't get access to dollars. And for a couple of the countries, it's actually not even the corporate level. It's the sovereign level that has the debts. So some countries like Argentina, the debts are at the sovereign level, whereas for other countries like Turkey, it's at the corporate level.
Okay, got it.
So the issue is there's all that dollar-denominated debt, and that's an artifact of the dollar being the global reserve currency of the past 50 years, and even before then, if you go to the pre-1971 system. So for decades of global reserve status, there's so much international trade, commodity pricing that all happens in dollars. So many countries borrow in dollars. And
correct me if I'm wrong, but they really levered up back in 2011, 2012. Meaning they bought a lot of dollars back then because the Fed took interest rates down to zero. And yep. The dollar, I think, was around 70 on the DXY.
Yeah, so, there was from the last dollar spike was it peaked around 2002 or so, 2001, 2002. And then it was on a long decline. And then it had that brief small spike during the 2008 crisis. But that was a pretty low period for the dollar, especially right after it. So from 2009, 2010, 2011, 12, 13, they could lever up. And then only in late 2014, the dollar strengthened. So for the past 5 years, we've been in this strong dollar environment. So there's all this just $12, $13 trillion in debt outside the United States, all denominated in dollars, and they're reliant on being able to get dollars to service that, and there's just a shortage of them, especially when in this environment with it was already a problem for the past several years, and that's part of why we've had kind of slow growth. But this crisis obviously brings it all to a head because trade is now greatly reduced, commodity prices are lower. So many companies suddenly can't get dollars, and it's more acute than it was over the past several years.
Right. I want to unpack that just a little bit before you move on, just so the viewers are following us here. So when there's a corporation in, let's say, China or Taiwan, anywhere outside of the United States, the way they get dollars is they produce something. They produce a widget. And then they send that widget to the United States and it goes into Walmart. And then Walmart gives for that widget, they give that company just green pieces of paper that we call dollars. So if there's a lot fewer widgets that are going around and being purchased by the United States, that means there's fewer dollars getting outside of the United States. And that just exacerbates the problem.
Yep. And then even if they get outside the United States, they're not necessarily getting to the right countries. So they could still be getting to Saudi Arabia. They still could be getting to China, but they're not necessarily getting to another country that needs them or specific companies that need them.
And does the price of oil make it even worse? Because I would assume that like a country that produced a lot of oil, that would be great for them because they're getting revenue in dollars. But if the price of oil goes from 100 a barrel down to 10, then they're getting a lot fewer dollars coming in. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, it means fewer dollars get out there, and then those countries have to tighten their belt. So they buy less stuff from another, like, say, non-oil producing nation. So the dollars circulate less because there's less of them spent on oil. There's less of them spent outside of the country.
Okay, got it. So let's move on to the core of the one report, that which I loved, where you're talking about creditor nations versus debtor nations.
Yes. So creditor nations, that's measured as the net international investment position, which is how much assets that people in that country or the government itself, but the total assets that that country has in other countries. So, for example, Japan owns a lot of assets in the United States and other countries. And then other countries own some pieces of Japanese assets. They could own Japanese stocks. They could own some Japanese real estate, some bonds. And the net international investment position is the difference between how much they own from other countries versus how much countries own of their assets. So a creditor nation owns more foreign assets than foreigners own of their assets. And a debtor nation is vice versa. So some of the largest creditor nations are Japan, Germany, Singapore, Switzerland, Norway, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, and then some of the biggest debtor nations. The United States is the largest absolute debtor nation, but then there's also, as a percentage of GDP, we're one of the worst, but there are some that are even worse, such as Spain, which is deeper in the debtor hole.
Okay. All right. Got it. So how does that that balance sheet, if you will, play out in terms of the strength or weakness of the dollar?
So in the short run, it can strengthen it because there's no, like I said, there's no dollars getting out there. But it also makes it so that in the intermediate term, it's the United States' problem that the dollar is so strong, because if all those foreign nations can't get dollars, a lot of them, even though they don't have dollars, they do have treasuries. Right. And they do have other U.S. assets, including stocks, corporate bonds, real estate. So if some of those creditor nations have to start, they have a more acute need for dollars, their central banks can sell treasuries to help try to bail out their, you know, their corporate sector. Right. And some private, you know, pensions or other institutions might have to sell U.S. stocks, U.S. corporate bonds. Some householders that are in trouble might have to sell, like, say, U.S. real estate or other holdings that they have. And currently the numbers are that the net international investment position for the U.S. is about a negative $11 trillion. So we own $29 trillion foreign assets, and foreigners collectively own about $40 trillion of our assets. So there's an $11 trillion hole that we have.
Okay, great. So if I'm a foreign entity, whether it's a sovereign or a corporate or even at the individual level, and I have dollar-denominated debt, but all I have coming in is my local currency, so I don't have any of those dollars, what you're saying is I might take some treasuries that are denominated in dollars, obviously, and yes, sell those into the market to get the dollars I need to pay down my debt.
Yes, and more specifically, you might have to work with your like their central bank of your country or other major banks within your country that would work with the central bank to get access to those dollars. If you don't have, because the company themselves might not be holding treasuries, they might have to get dollars in a loan, some sort of currency swap with their domestic institutions, which then either have to sell treasuries or use other means to get dollars.
Okay, got it. So any of these assets that we're selling that are denominated in dollars, most likely that could put pressure or downward pressure on the dollar because you're just creating more supply. And then with treasuries more specifically, though, if you're getting a lot of treasuries that are being sold into the market, that potentially could lower the price, increase the interest rate, which would cause a lot of problems for the United States government and our local domestic economy. So that's kind of where the Fed has stepped in. Is that correct?
Yeah, so a lot of their recent, it's called the alphabet soup of different programs they've done, often explicitly cite the treasury market as the catalyst for them doing it. They keep citing how it's been illiquid, it's been very disorderly, and in mid-March, it crashed pretty significantly, the treasury prices. So if you look at TLT, at one point it was down about 16% from its highs. And all those long bonds crashed pretty hard. And that's because there was so much foreign selling pressure. And some domestic hedge funds and other institutions also were net sellers due to leverage. But foreigners specifically sold over $100 billion worth of treasuries in a very short period of time. And historically, this happens when the dollar strengthens, because suddenly, it happened back in 2016 when we had that global slowdown. We had recessions in several countries such as Brazil, Russia. We had the oil price reduction, and we saw the same dynamic there. So the dollar spiked, the Dixie went up to like 103, 104, and we saw foreigners unloading treasuries to get dollars.
Okay,
and
so why does the dollar going up in relative to other currencies, why does that increase more demand for dollars?
Because when it's going up, it's indicative of a dollar shortage. So it's kind of a self-feedback loop. So it's going up partially because there's a shortage of dollars. And then the more it goes up relative to local currencies, the harder it is for them to get dollars.
So the dollar index going up is more of a symptom of what's going on, which is creating the need to sell the treasuries.
What they're trying to do is not have to buy almost the entire treasury market. So they're buying hundreds of billions of dollars in treasuries per week now. But some of the other measures that they're doing are to try to make it so they don't have to buy as many. So for example, they're doing currency swaps, so they can give dollars without necessarily exchanging treasuries. It's a loan. And then they also now have an international repo. So foreign central banks can loan their treasuries back to the Fed rather than sell treasuries on the open market in order to get dollars temporarily. So the Fed would prefer that than all this outright hard selling of treasuries.
Right. It seems to me like the Fed's just trying to get as many of these assets on their balance sheet as they possibly can, so there's fewer sellers, and just to prop up the prices. Do you see it that way as well?
Well, yeah. Basically, there's not enough buyers for all the sellers, both international and domestically. So the Fed's finding themselves as, instead of the buyer of last resort, they're becoming like the only major buyer of treasuries. Some traders are, of course, buying, but the only buyer at scale right now is the Fed. They're buying, they're the major buyer. And they have to do that because there's just not enough dollars, not enough buyers to buy all those treasuries. But then they don't want to just keep it going at this rate, because they don't want to buy the entire treasury market or the entire international treasury market. They'd rather provide some of these loans to bridge the gap until hopefully they get trade back up. And then foreigners are under less pressure to sell treasuries. They want to not buy more than they necessarily have to.
Yeah, what are the downsides there? I mean, I think I understand them, but for the audience, what would the downside be of the Fed just buying the entire treasury market? Then problem solved. You don't have to worry about interest rates. We don't have to worry about all these pesky sellers.
Oh, in the long run, it's result in currency devaluation, most likely, because the dollar actually has a lot of fundamental problems with it at the moment. Like it's overvalued based on a lot of metrics. So as you relieve the dollar shortage, on the other side of this, there's a pretty good likelihood that we're going to see a weaker dollar, and then you open up the can of worms for inflation and other consequences like that.
When you say inflation, how would you define that as far as numbers? Do you define that as anything over? Well, I know it literally, it's just above zero. I understand that. But when we get into serious inflation, maybe that's a better question. How would you define serious inflation? Does it get up to 8%, 10% or higher? Or what type of range do you see?
That's a possibility. I mean, I would define inflation as getting notably above the Fed's target of 2%. Mm-hmm. Even if it's, they might target 2.5-3%, because now they changed the goalposts. Now they're targeting symmetric inflation. So they had inflation below 2%. So now they're kind of happy with maybe 2-3%. But if you start seeing inflation get to 4-5%, that's not in there. That's not in their playbook.
Yeah, and let's just say that inflation got to 4-5%, or maybe even higher. How do they combat that if they're if they're basically trying to peg the yield curve?
The best playbook we have to compare what they did is all the way back in the 1940s. They actually kind of encountered that situation. So that's the last time that U.S. debt to GDP got this high. It's the only other time in history it was this high. It was actually slightly higher back then. Mm. And that was, of course, for World War II. And so what the Fed did was they did yield curve control. So they worked with the Treasury, and then they basically said, like, we'll buy any Treasury we need to at 2.5%. So they locked the yield curve. The T-bill was at something like 0.38%, and then the long duration stuff was at 2.5%.
Okay.
And they said that's, you know, and then all the in the middle of that, there's, you know, 1%, 1.5%. So they had this low positive yield curve, and they just kind of overrode the market and said, we'll use our infinite balance sheet, and that's what the yield curve is. So inflation actually in 1942 and then again in 1947, inflation got into the double digits.
As high as the 70s.
Yeah, the actual peak was a little bit higher than the 70s. It was just less sustained. So we had these kind of bursts of double-digit inflation. And if you look at that period, for the whole, like, 1940s, that whole decade, treasuries lost a lot of value on a real basis, even though they made money nominally. You got paid 2.5%. There were no defaults. But your actual purchasing power with those treasuries went down because they locked the yield curve below the inflation rate for several years.
Right. So a couple things there. When I think about the debt or the debt to GDP being that high back in World War II, it seems as though it's so much different now, because back then it was just like one-time costs. Like if I'm looking at it like a business, okay, well, I'm not going to be in a world war for the next 50 years. It's not a recurring cost. It's not like my monthly rent. It's just kind of a one-time fee, where now it seems like the balance sheet or the debt side is just all these recurring costs that are the opposite. They're not one time. It's going to be there forever. Am I seeing it correctly?
Yes. And my thesis that I started kind of presenting in around September, October of last year with the repo spike is that we're getting kind of close to the end of this dollar cycle. And that over the next 5+ years, we're very likely to see a weaker dollar for that reason, because a lot of attention right now is on the virus and this, you know, current recession. But we went into this crisis with a $1 trillion deficit in the United States. Right. So it was 5% of GDP, and it was structural. It's based on, you know, our current plan of entitlement spending, healthcare, military spending, like the whole kind of permanent financial budget we have in place. It's out of whack. So we had this growing deficit going into this crisis, whereas normally during economic expansions, we rarely have surpluses, but at least they narrow the deficit generally during expansions, whereas this one towards the end of it was the opposite. We started to have growing deficits as a percentage of GDP going into this crisis. So for the next year or 2 years, we're going to have very large deficits, but that's on top of a structural deficit. So even after that's all over, we're still looking at nothing but deficits for, you know, until they change something.
Right, but that means a lot of selling pressure in the treasury market, because it basically a treasury is just a long-dated kind of dollar.
Yep.
And so if I'm holding dollars and I'm committing to hold those dollars for, call it 30 years, do I really want to do that at a 2% interest rate when I see inflation potentially going to 3, 4, 5, 8, 10%, you're losing a lot of money in purchasing power, even though you're getting paid back nominally. So what's going on in my head is I'm saying, okay, I get it. I see how this could increase interest rates due to inflation expectations. But I also see that the Fed, the very last thing they want is for interest rates to go up, because technically, if interest rates got high enough and went there fast enough, that could be as detrimental to the economy as the virus we're dealing with. I mean, if they went high enough. So how does that play out? How does the Fed prevent interest rates from going up while there's higher inflation expectations?
So the main way they do it is because their balance sheet is technically infinite. So they can create money, buy bonds, and on that front, there's no limit. But of course, there's no free lunch. So the limit ends up being that the currency weakens. So They can technically set the yield at whatever they want to set it at. They can say, okay, the free market wants to set the yield at 3, 4, or 5%. If we get to that period where, you know, debt's going up, inflation's increasing, and the market wants to have higher rates, they can override that. Right. So they have the power to do that, but they can't override that and maintain currency strength. So the release valve would be, you lower the yields, but then you lose value for the dollar. So you that's generally the release valve of how this works. And if you look at the long-term debt cycle, that's normally how debt cycles play out. Whenever you get to debt just this high, most regimes end up devaluing their currency, either intentionally or unintentionally.
Yeah, that's really my point, is that if the Fed is trying to peg the yield curve with the yield curve control, and they're having to print more dollars to do that, then that's going to increase inflation expectations, which the market would want to push rates up while the Fed's trying to push them down. So everything that the Fed is doing to push rates down, it makes the market sell more bonds. So you get kind of this, like I call it a doom vortex, or Raul calls it like a doom loop, where it just feeds on itself. And the more the Fed tries to peg those rates, the more money they print, the more inflation expectations, the more the market sells off the long end of the yield curve. That seems to me like that gets really bad really quick, as far as the release valve being the dollar. I mean, does and then I also want to define for the viewers that when you're talking about inflation, are you talking about just domestic deflation with consumer prices, or inflation, excuse me? Are you talking about maybe asset inflation, or are you talking about inflation or a devalued dollar relative to other currencies? Because what we've seen in the past is you can have all these things happening at the same time. The dollar can be going up outside the United States, but we can also see 4 or 5% CPI increases. So how do you compartmentalize inflation?
Sure. So it always depends on a couple of different variables. And one example I like to use is Japan. So I did a case study for Japan for their 2012 to 2015 period. So people often cite Japan as this example of printing a ton of money and so far not getting a ton of consequences for it. They printed, like their central bank balance sheet is over 100% of their GDP, whereas the Fed going into this crisis was 20% of our GDP. It's probably already up to 25% now or something like that. But the ECB went into this at about 40% of Eurozone GDP. So Japan is very far ahead on the curve for how much they've already printed. But if you look at the timeline of when they did that, they really started ramping up printing in late 2012. That's when they their balance sheet starts. It was kind of flat, and then it just starts going up at a slope, and it just doesn't stop all the way to today. Like it started to go a little bit slower, but it's just been a diagonal move up.
Yeah, I call it the Buzz Lightyear balance sheet for it's an infinity and beyond, right?
Pretty much, yeah. So their debt to GDP is well over 200%, and they've just printed a massive amount of money to buy a very large portion of their sovereign bonds, and then in addition, stocks and other assets. And if you look at what happened to their currency, so starting in late 2012, right when they started that massive ramp up in their printing, the yen devalued significantly compared to the dollar. So the yen was 70 something yen, like maybe 74 yen to the dollar. And then by 2015, 3 years later, it was like 120 yen to the dollar. So they had a very significant yen devaluation. And it also devalued against major other currencies, not quite as much as it did to the dollar, but it was, you know, compared to the euro, it lost value. But they didn't experience any domestic inflation. Like they didn't have a lot of price inflation at the consumer level. So that's an example of a non-inflationary devaluation. So it's not, like you point out, there's different variables. You can have devaluation without necessarily consumer price inflation.
Could we have the opposite? Could we have consumer price inflation when the CPI, but yet the dollar getting quote unquote strong?
You could, if there's inflation in other countries, in addition to the United States, you could have inflation, but the dollar's still retaining strength versus other currencies. Now, I don't consider that as probable in this environment, but it's definitely like a, in the realm of things that mathematically can happen.
Okay. Yeah. The way I, and I, trust me, I'm by no means an economist and I'm just some crazy person on YouTube, but the way I, or some of the components to the puzzle that I saw are just potentially MMT coming down the line, more so in the future. I think once people get a few checks, it becomes more of a permanent government program, like every temporary government program. And the more they do this and create additional money supply in the real economy through additional deposits, because most of my viewers know from watching my videos that if the Fed prints money, it's just a bank reserve. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's additional money supply that's circulating with velocity in the economy chasing goods or services. So I see MMT as a way of increasing the deposits. And then also with these four-letter, five-letter alphabet soup programs, that might also create more deposits. And then you might have fewer goods and services because of deglobalization and disrupted supply chains. So you have more money chasing the same amount or fewer amount of goods and services, while at the same time, with the disruption of imports from global supply chains, you don't have as many dollars getting outside to service the debt that we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. So that's where you might get that dollar getting quote-unquote strong while we see consumer price inflation. Am I not seeing it correctly, though? Because, again, I'm by no means a professional.
No, that's certainly possible. There are parts of that that I would totally agree with, and then the other parts that, while they could happen, they're not in my base case for what would happen. So the part that I definitely agree with is the fiscal side or the MMT side, and that's okay. The thing you have to watch because – so after 2008, as you pointed out, they did a lot of QE – but it's bank reserves, so they weren't sending out checks to everyone. It wasn't getting down to the everyday buying level. So we had an expansion of the monetary base. We had, you know, the balance sheet went up, but we didn't have, the average person didn't have more money, so there wasn't a lot of money chasing the same level of products. So we didn't have consumer price inflation. Going forward, if like we're already seeing, you know, checks going out, but it depends on what they do going forward fiscally, because we don't know how long this is going to last. We don't know how hard it's going to be to take away the money once they've been giving it out. Like, I don't know how easy it's going to be to say, okay, we're done with checks. So in order to see that inflation on the consumer level, there has to be a mechanism to get money into the hands of people. And that's what you could find that really causes that inflation to get out of control. So over the past 10 years in this cycle, we have seen inflation in financial assets. We've seen inflation in healthcare. We've seen inflation in luxury goods. But due to the combination of technology, which is generally deflationary, especially for consumer goods, electronics, because it makes things more efficient, and outsourcing, these are been deflationary forces for consumer prices, combined with the fact that money wasn't really getting down to the common person level. So you didn't see a lot of money chasing few goods. So we didn't really have that consumer price inflation. But it's definitely more of a risk going forward, not necessarily this year, because we have these current deflationary forces. But on the other side of this, when we still have these large structural deficits, we still have whatever damage is still lingering from this recession, this debt crisis, it's certainly possible that you're going to keep seeing that sort of injection of money into mainstream, and especially because that money's not being extracted anywhere else. It's not being extracted with taxes. It's not being extracted from the economy. It's just new money that's kind of entering the economy, but it's a matter of magnitude and where it ends up.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so where you're saying, George, you probably got the probabilities a little bit wrong, is you're seeing the demand shock being so extreme that there's just not going to be velocity there, even though those dollars are getting out into the system in the next, in the short term, maybe the next year or so. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well, it depends what they do later this year. But at the current time, especially if you look at the magnitude of how much money is getting to the middle class, right? Yeah. So if everybody gets a $1,200 check and you get some checks for kids, that portion of the whole bill is several hundred billion dollars, which sounds like a lot, but compared to the multi-trillion dollar money supply and compared to the $22 trillion GDP, it's still not this giant inflationary impulse. It's mostly offsetting the reduction in equity prices, the reduction in, we could have a reduction in home equity, the reduction in incomes that people have. So right now, it's at the current stage, it's not likely to be inflationary. But on the other side of this, we could certainly see more inflation. And in the near term, we could see very targeted inflation, like inflation of toilet paper or some good that is, you know, scarce that everyone suddenly wants.
I think the probabilities of that are extremely high.
Yeah.
We all know toilet paper is going up in price. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm totally following what you're saying. If the consumers, the average Joes and Janes out there, take the money from the government, let's say they're locked up in their house, they're really worried about what's happening in the future, maybe with their job, with the economy, and they're like, listen, I've got this credit card debt, I've got this XYZ debt, I'm just going to take this money and pay off some of these lines of credit that I have. That could potentially lower or decrease the money supply. It all depends on psychology. And so if that's correct, could you kind of explain to the viewer how paying off debt decreases the money supply? So even though the government is creating all these currency units or putting them into existence, it could actually create deflation from a price standpoint.
Well, yeah, definitely in the near term, because if you pay off a debt, you're paying off your, if you eliminate debt, you're basically also taking away an asset, so someone else's asset. So, you know, people, their confidence in spending partially comes from how much money they have in the bank account, but also it comes from what are their stock and bond portfolio worth, what is their home equity worth. That can all influence consumer behavior. And it's also like your availability of credit. So if you have a home and it recently went up a lot in value, and then you take a home equity loan out of it, and then you go buy a new car with it. So it's just, it's, you can extract a lot of spending power from these non-money assets. You can monetize them. Right. So if you have a reduction in stock prices or home equity, and then also you have consumers that are suddenly more fearful about losing their income or losing their spouse's income, and just like their overall income picture is less stable, they can spend less and they can leverage less, and they can even, you know, reduce existing leverage. So you could see that near-term deflation if people aren't confident to spend, you know, outside of certain targeted areas like necessities.
Okay, great. Got it. I just wanted to give people both sides of the short-term argument there for kind of a local domestic, assuming we've got a U.S. viewer, the local domestic inflation compared to maybe local domestic deflation. Well, let's circle back, if we can, to the report where you're talking about the creditor nations and the debtor nations. And I'd like to kind of think through, if the Fed is pegging the yield curve and that's creating inflation expectations, we talked about how that works domestically, but outside of the United States, if I'm one of these nations that's a creditor nation and a lot of the assets that I have dollar denominated are treasuries, I think I want to be a seller of those treasuries as well. So, I mean, how much money would the Fed, or how many dollars would they have to print to potentially absorb all of this dollar selling that would most likely be a result of future inflation expectations? And then I guess the next step would be, is the demand for dollars because of all the debt enough to absorb that? I mean, how do those cross currents really play out?
Sure. So the way that I start with currency assessment is that the trade balance is kind of at the heart of it, because in a normal system, currencies eventually find an equilibrium around trade. So if a country runs a persistent trade deficit, generally what happens is there's some sort of financial crisis or some sort of shock that happens, and suddenly they're forced to reduce their consumption of imports, and their currency generally weakens, and that weakening makes it so they can import less. So for example, we looked at that with Turkey, for example. Turkey was running a big deficit, trade deficit, and then when their currency had this big weakening, suddenly that kind of was a self-reinforcing cycle. So they now are importing less because they have to, because they have a weakening currency.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to unpack that for the viewer. So the reason they import less because they can't afford those products because their currency goes down in value. Yep. All of a sudden you go to Walmart and everything's quadruple price because the dollar goes down theoretically against the Chinese yuan or something. Okay.
Yep. And so that makes it so that they have to import less. And also it makes their exports more competitive because, you know, suddenly, say, if you're using the example of Turkey, suddenly Turkish labor is pretty cheap for foreigners to access their products and services. So it lowers their imports, it boosts their exports generally, as long as it's still a functioning economy, as long as it's not a failed state like something like Venezuela, as long as you have a functioning economy, it helps the currency find an equilibrium, because once you have the trade balance start to settle out again, that's kind of where the currency can find a floor and then start, you know, stabilizing from there. And that's actually what we saw in that example with Japan from 2012 to 2015. Even though Japan kept printing money after that, you know, they printed money starting in 2012, they printed it all the way through 2015, and then they kept printing all the way up through 2020. They're still printing, but their currency stopped weakening in 2015. And actually it's strengthened slightly versus the dollar since then. It's still way above, you know, it's still way weaker than it was, before, like in 2012, but it's down from its peak weakness. It's strengthened a little bit. And that's because if you look at their trade deficit over the same time, they basically hit equilibrium. So, Japan has a long history of having, positive trade balances and positive current account balances. And that's how they built up their large creditor status. But in around 2012, they actually had a rare trade deficit. So, you know, the economy was pretty weak at that time. They had large fiscal deficits. They started to have a small trade deficit. And when they started printing aggressively, it weakened their currency. So we saw that effect where they, you know, it made their exports more competitive and it made their imports a little bit more expensive for them. And so within that three-year period, we saw that the trade deficit went back down to zero, roughly, and their current account was slightly positive. And from there, even though they kept printing aggressively, their currency stopped weakening because it kind of found that equilibrium of where, you know, if it weakens any further, it's going to push them into a trade surplus because suddenly their products are going to keep getting more and more cheap. So if we think of it like that, most currencies eventually, sometimes they find it quickly, sometimes they can take years to find that equilibrium, but they generally find an equilibrium around trade. Now, the U.S. is a little bit different because we have the global reserve currency, so we have this kind of extra layer of demand for the dollar over the past several decades. Right. And in some ways, that's a good thing, but it's also very bad for our manufacturing because it means that our currency never really gets a chance to find its equilibrium to balance out our trade balance. So part of being the world reserve currency is that we have to run trade deficits persistently in order to provide the world with dollars. Like if we have a global system where all oil pricing and most commodity pricing is in dollars, there has to be enough dollars out there in the global system. They can't all just be in the U.S.
Right. So, Tripping's paradox.
Yep, exactly. So after several decades of this, we're kind of on the wrong side of Triffin's paradox. We're on the, you know, we got all the benefits decades ago. But now, you know, because we have the privilege to be able to print money for oil and other hard assets. But decades and decades of this, we've had very persistent trade deficits. After World War One, World War Two, we were the world's largest creditor nation. So, you know, we had more foreign assets than foreigners owned of our assets. And then that slowly deteriorated. So by 1985, we went into debtor status slightly. And then during the previous recession in 2007, 2008, our net international investment position was negative 10% of our GDP. So we were, you know, kind of a mild debtor status. And then since then, in just that 12 years, in 2020, we're now down to below negative 50% of GDP because we continue to run very large trade deficits because our currency is just overvalued consistently compared to what it would be if it could just find an equilibrium because the global dollar shortage keeps it up and the fact that all commodity pricing globally happen or most commodity pricing happens in dollars, it provides this constant demand that wouldn't exist if we didn't have this you know, current setup in place.
Right. So I got a zillion questions here. Let's start with trying to explain to the viewer who might be kind of very new to this. They know a lot of my viewers are incredibly intelligent. All of them are incredibly intelligent, but they have varying degrees of understanding of kind of our lingo and the economic jargon and whatnot. They just see what's going on with the Fed and they have a visceral feeling that, hey, something's not right here. This, you just can't print money with no consequence. Yeah. I need to watch one of George's videos to figure out what's going on. So for that type of person, let's explain why being a creditor, kind of the pros and cons of being a creditor nation compared to a debtor nation.
So a creditor nation, you kind of think of it as a household, even though, of course, at the sovereign level, the economics get very different than a household level. But but if you think of it as a household, a creditor nation is like, you know, you have maybe a low mortgage, but you have tons of home equity, you have tons of assets, you have money in the bank account, you own a rental property, like you're in good shape financially. You have some debts, but you have more assets.
Lynn, before you dex, I'm sure what everyone's thinking in their mind right now is how can Japan be a creditor nation when they have 220% debt to GDP? And I get that, but if you could answer that simple one, because I think that's kind of where people really get confused. Yeah.
Often if you say creditor nation or debtor nation, they assume it's like a sovereign debt to GDP, but that's it's a different measure. So that's, they do have that problem, but the main variable there is that they own most of their own debt. So most of their sovereign debt, as large as it is held by their citizens and their central bank. So most of that debt is not held by foreigners. Like we don't own most of Japanese debt. You know, other creditor nations don't own much of Japan's debt. They own most of their own debt, but then they also own a lot of our debt, and they own a lot of, you know, European assets and just assets around the world. So that's where that comes from. That they it's a different metric.
Got it. So now we're talking about their or Japan and how they're a creditor nation. You're comparing it to a household. So they just have a lot more assets at their disposal. It puts them into a more powerful position. Is there any downside to the creditor nation?
One of the downsides is that their currency has a tendency to strengthen, which Switzerland actually finds themselves in this position. So Switzerland's one of the largest creditor nations. And they have a large trade surplus and current account surplus. And if left to its own devices, their currency would keep strengthening to the point where their products would be very uneconomical, like uncompetitive in the global landscape. So like they're known for, you know, their banking services, obviously, but they also have manufacturing, like high skilled manufacturing. And we're willing to pay up for that quality. But if they let it strengthen so much, eventually they'd price themselves out of the market,
right?
And they'd actually start to get either a smaller trade surplus or even a trade deficit, and they could start to kind of unwind that position. So what the Swiss National Bank does is they actually print a ton of money, but then unlike the Fed or the ECB or the Bank of Japan, they use most of that money printing to buy foreign assets. So they're purposely printing more of their money to try to weaken it, and then buying foreign assets with it. So it kind of keeps their creditor status up, while also trying to weaken their currency. And then the downside of that is that they can get called currency manipulators by other countries, because that's what they're actually trying to do. They're trying to, you know, they have some of the most negative interest rates in the world, and then they also are printing just huge amounts of money. Like their balance sheet, last I checked, is kind of like Japan, where it's like 100% of their GDP.
Right.
But the main difference being that a lot of their assets are external assets.
Right.
Because they have the kind of the quote unquote problem of a currency that's too strong.
Right. So if and this is kind of a joking question, but if interest rates are the price of money or the currency, and the central banks, especially the Fed, is manipulating artificially the interest rate, isn't every single country a currency manipulator, especially the United States?
Essentially, yes. Yeah, it's all a matter of how much they're manipulating it. And then also different viewers view it in different things. So China gets accused of being a currency manipulator a lot, right? So because they want to keep their currency, they don't want their currency to be too strong because they rely on exports. But at the same time, people think that, you know, China is a big Ponzi scheme and they're propping up their currency. So it's like, which is it? Are they
right?
Are they propping it up or are they weakening it? You know?
Okay, exactly. So now let's dive into the United States and what's the downside there with being such a debtor nation and how you see that playing out over the next few years.
So there's a couple major downsides. The biggest one is that the group of people that suffers a lot from that is the American working class, middle class. So we've exported a lot of our industrial base to foreign markets, especially China, but even Europe, especially in this 5-year strong dollar environment from 2014 to present. Europe has a very large trade surplus with the United States. So we often think as China as being the one that we have a big trade deficit with, which is true. But even Europe, as a developed continent, they actually are far more competitive in terms of like manufactured products than us, because their currency is not overvalued like ours is. So like there's a reason we drive German cars and Japanese cars, and they don't really drive American cars, because our currency is just always too strong in order to make our products as competitive as they could be on the global market.
So this
whole process of deindustrialization, it benefits some people, but it's about, say, 50 or 70% of the country that's more harmed by it.
Right. But as far as the United States moving forward relative to the dollar and inflation and interest rates on the long end of the yield curve, if we are this huge debtor nation, that means that so many of those foreigners own our assets or dollar denominated assets. And that puts us in a potential position of weakness where the only thing that we can do is print money to try to either get those assets back onto the balance sheet of the Fed, or the bottom line is it puts us in a position where you just got to print money. Yep. You got to print dollars, more dollars.
Unfortunately, yeah. They can, historically, regimes, when they have this kind of debt crisis, they can either let it collapse, which they almost never choose, or they can print and devalue their currency, which is what they almost always choose to do.
If we try to start buying U.S., so no more imports from China or India or Europe, isn't that going to create another problem in the sense that it's going to exacerbate inflation because we don't have any of those supply chains set up? We have a higher cost of labor instead of outsourcing to a lower cost labor pool. And then how does that combine with the Fed having to print money and create more dollars at the same time?
So going back to what I said before, if currency is trying to find an equilibrium value, basically around trade, and our biggest problem now is that we're on the wrong side of Triffin dilemma, where after decades of being the world reserve currency and decades of trade imbalances, we have a very deep negative debtor position, and we have a very uncompetitive industrial base, and we have an overvalued currency. And that because we're the world reserve currency, because we have this dollar shortage where there's so much debt, dollar diamond debt outside of the country, that it currently doesn't give our currency a chance to weaken. We never get down to that equilibrium where our currency can find its natural resting point where we become competitive again. And there's a couple ways that's probably going to be addressed over time. One is, I think naturally what they're doing now on the other side of this, whether they like it or not, they're probably going to have a weaker dollar, even though in the near term, there's a risk of a spiking dollar if they don't provide enough liquidity to get through this period. But on the other side of this, when we look at how large deficits are going to be, when we look at how much debt there is in the system and what our trade balance is, if we alleviate the dollar liquidity problem, then the natural resting place of the dollar is lower. And that's what we found over the past few months. So, for example, starting with the repo spike in September of 2019, the Fed started printing money to basically backstop the repo market and expanding its balance sheet. And that helped in the short term alleviate the dollar shortage. So we started to see the dollar index fall from about 99 to about 96. And then it stopped. They stopped printing around right at the turn of the year in January 2020. So we started to have the dollar strengthen again. And then, of course, it all blew up when we had this virus. It shut everything down. We had the dollar breakout. You know, Dixie got up to about 103. But basically, on the other side of this, once the dollar liquidity shortage is addressed, we're probably going to see a naturally weaker dollar. And then over the longer run, that's where you get into geopolitical solutions. So, for example, you can have multi-currency oil pricing so that the dollar isn't, you know, the only currency out there to buy commodities with. So that the dollar has kind of less, you know, natural demand for it. Basically, for many decades, it was in the national interest to have a strong dollar. But now it's more of a natural interest to have, you know, a dollar that's not necessarily weaker, but that is just at its equilibrium price, which is weaker. So it's not like we don't want an artificially weak dollar, but we want the dollar to be able to find its resting value.
Where do you think that equilibrium is?
Well, if we look at what happened in 2008, the dollar, like our imports fell pretty considerably, and our trade deficit narrowed a little bit. But even that wasn't quite enough. And that was, you know, Dixie was down below 80. And even that wasn't quite enough of an equilibrium value to get us down to break even. So probably equilibrium value is below 80 on the dollar index.
So what happened with our trade when we were down at 70 on the DXY in 2011 or 12? Did we see a big difference there?
Yeah, our trade deficit narrowed significantly after that whole crisis. After it kind of sharply came back in during 2008 or so, and it narrowed, but it still remained negative, even with a dollar index below 80. So that showed that we definitely were closer to equilibrium, but we still weren't even at equilibrium at that value.
So it might be equilibrium, maybe 60 or 55, something like that.
Could be 60, could be 70, could be 65. It's, you know, it's okay. A moving target. It depends what the other currencies are doing.
Right. And then how much of the debt that we're talking about, so demand for dollars outside the United States, how much of that is short term, meaning they got to roll it over like every 2 years or 3 years, or is it more longer dated debt?
There's a big spectrum of it. A lot of it's short term, a lot of it's medium, longer term. Also, the BIS has a breakdown of how much of it is loans versus bonds. Over time, more of it has shifted towards bonds. I don't know the exact maturity profile offhand, but it's a pretty broad set of maturities.
The reason I ask that is, do you see these entities outside the United States, when they have to roll over that debt, do you see them rolling it back over into dollars, or maybe saying, wait a minute, this probably isn't a good idea. Let's borrow in some other current, maybe a local currency, and that creating less demand for the dollar on a moving forward basis.
Yeah, so there is a pretty big market for euro-denominated debt. So that's a logical choice. Also, China's been active in lending, but they have generally been lending in dollars you know, for their Belt and Road Initiative. So you could see a diversification of the type of lending they do. Also, we're starting to see different countries actively seek to de-dollarize. So Russia's been kind of spearheading that, where they've been trying to do deals with China and Europe to price oil in non-dollar terms. And they've had some arms deals with India, where they priced it in rubles. If Russia, China, Europe has an interest in being able to buy oil with euros, if we start to see multi-currency oil pricing, then naturally some of those dollar-denominated debts could shift to other currencies because they're less locked into this dollar status.
Yeah, so you see that being a trend on a moving forward basis.
I believe so. It's hard to see it not move forward at this point because back when the global reserve currency was established, the United States was a very large portion of the global economy. And we're also the world's largest commodity consumer, importer. So now China imports more oil than we do, and yet oil is still predominantly priced in dollars, which, you know, it used to make sense, and now it we're in a world where it makes less sense. Even for a lot of people might think, you know, the United States would never let this go. We would use our military to protect the fact that we have the global reserve currency. Right. But it's, as for reasons I've discussed, it's actually you know, no longer in the U.S. interest to have a currency this strong. It's just not benefiting our industrial base. You know, we can't even make masks. It turns out, like, we're at a shortage of masks. So historically, the U.S. has put pressure on any attempt by countries to price their oil in something other than dollars. Either sometimes, you know, there's been military actions that are coincidentally in countries that have recently priced oil in euros or other currencies. And then most recently, Russia was pricing oil in euros and we ramped up sanctions on them. But going forward, it's you know, I think they're going to figure out that it's not necessarily in their best interest to lock all oil globally in dollar terms.
So it sounds like a weaker dollar is beneficial for all parties involved, which would which will bring me to kind of my last question here. I really appreciate your time. And that's if the DXY, and that's the measurement of the dollar compared to the, really the euro, but a basket of currencies outside the U.S., if that gets up to 110, 120, to where it is just putting immense amount of pressure on those entities that borrowed in dollars, and then it's also putting pressure on the United States domestic economy, do we have a Plaza Accord 2.0 type of thing, or how do you see that being resolved if we get to that big spike that, that Brent Johnson, as an example, is predicting?
So it's possible. A spike of that magnitude, one thing I've always viewed is that some of the dollar bulls underestimate how damaging that spike would be for the U.S., including U.S. historically U.S. asset prices. So, for example, when the dollar spiked in 2008, the spike of the dollar coincided almost perfectly with the bottom in the U.S. stock market. When we hit that bottom in early 2009, that was within days.
I think you had
days,
a chart on that in your report. Yeah.
Yep, it was within days of the dollar spike. And then if you also look at U.S. corporate profits over the past, you know, 50, 60 years, the three major dollar spikes that we had in 1985 and then 2001 and then currently, these, like, you know, each one lasts like roughly 5 years. U.S. corporate profits go flatline for that whole period, including this, you know, even though we've had pretty strong S&P 500 earnings when you take into account tax cuts and buybacks. If you actually look at top line, you know, earnings and top line revenue, it's been really flat for the past 5 years. And then we saw the same thing the last two times we had these dollar spikes. So it makes it so that, you know, our products are way less competitive globally. And then also because the S&P 500 has over 40% of their revenue outside the United States.
Yeah, they're all multinational, sure.
Yep. And all that currency gets translated back into fewer dollars when the dollar is strong.
But then of course their expenses are denominated in dollars.
Yep.
So that makes things even worse. Yes. Okay. So this has been a fantastic conversation, but I know my viewers would be extremely angry with me if I didn't ask you about what you think is going to happen to, let's do this. Let's do dollar short term, meaning the next year, dollar long term, maybe 3 years plus. And then gold, what do you see? And then I don't know if you know anything about Bitcoin, but I've got a lot of viewers who really love the crypto space as well.
Sure. So I became more leaning bearish on the dollar starting in October of last year. So the past 6 months or so. Now this current virus definitely gave a short term headwind. So we definitely got like this dollar spike, at least a small one for now. So we hit about 103 in the dollar index. I think it's possible that was the local top, but it's very dependent on policy. So it depends on how much the Fed does to keep a lid on the dollar liquidity problem. So predicting the near term is challenging because it depends on how good people are at trying to do what they say they're trying to do. So as long as the Fed keeps providing liquidity and, you know, we could see that the dollar top's already in. It's also possible we retest that, maybe go a little bit above that if this persists longer than people think and if the Fed doesn't, you know, stay ahead of it. And then another backup option, you asked before, like, what are the options if the dollar spikes? We saw recently headlines where the IMF is also willing to provide dollar loans and also provide dollar liquidity to help the Fed in any sort of holes that they might have, because the biggest threat right now is to countries that have dollar debts but then are not creditor nations and don't have dollar assets to sell. So right. That's countries like Mexico, Indonesia, Chile, like multiple countries that just don't have the dollar assets to fund their dollar liabilities. Turkey, yeah. Argentina. So they're the ones that are at risk of default, at risk of major currency weakness. Whereas countries like South Korea or China, even though they have dollar denominated debts, they also have a lot of dollar assets.
Yeah, and so I heard the request at the IMF went up like to just to some astronomical number. Like they generally yep. get one request a month and they got 80 requests in the last week or something like that.
Just multiple countries are either have defaulted or at risk of default or at risk of major currency weakness because they don't have the dollar assets to sell. So they're the most vulnerable currently. Okay. So in the near term, the next year or so, it really depends on the Fed and the IMF. How much liquidity they can provide, because right now the dollar shortage overrides any sort of currency fundamentals of the dollar itself, because it's all about getting your hands on dollars to service the debts. Right. So my base case is that I expect them to, you know, every day that the dollar goes up, they will introduce new tools to try to provide liquidity. So whether it's currency swaps, which they already did, they're now doing international repos. They can lend treasuries. If countries have to outright sell treasuries, they'll buy them. So we might have seen the top. You might retest the top. And worst case scenarios, you can see a spike if they just totally drop the ball and this whole thing persists longer than they expect. Over the longer term, I expect to see the dollar weaken, because after they address this dollar shortage, and the government's just going to run massive deficits and also trade deficits and fiscal deficits, so large twin deficits. Those dollars eventually get outside of the country through trade, and we're just not propped up by the dollar shortage. So over the past...
I'm sorry, but I just want to insert one thing there. And also, too, that once the Fed takes their balance sheet up to 20 or 30 trillion, who knows what they have to. It's not like they can take that money out of circulation. Yep. They can't unwind that balance sheet. Yep. Look what happened when they tried to do QT from, what, call it 4.5 down to 3.8, and the whole thing blows up with yep. the repo market. So once you get the balance sheet up to that level, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's no turning back. You're in the Hotel California, so to speak.
Yeah, I think once we get past this dollar shortage and all the printing that's about to happen, the dollar is going to have a better chance of finding its equilibrium value, or at least getting closer, at least getting closer to it. So if you rank all the G7 countries by twin deficit, the U.S. is tied as the worst. And then out of the two, we're tied with Britain as the worst. But then in terms of net international investment position, we are the worst. So our equilibrium value is much lower over the multi-year long term if they let it get there. And then even if they try not to let it get there, I think it's still eventually going to find its way to get down there.
All right. So I'm guessing I already know your position on gold, but let's hear it. Let's hear it right from Lynn Alden herself.
Yeah, I'm bullish on gold and silver for the long term. If we see a brief dollar spike upward, we still could get more pressure on them in the near term. But I definitely consider them important holdings for the long term. I started adding them to my portfolio in 2008, I've actually been investing in precious metals since the late 1990s. But I originally sold my collection back in 2011, and right. then it's been since 2018 that I've been buying back pretty sizable physical positions, in addition to miners, royalty companies, and other ways of getting exposure.
So you bought at the absolute low, or maybe at the absolute low, you sold at the absolute peak, and then now you're starting to buy again, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Part of my sale was luck. It was like there's so much positive sentiment, and so I just I unloaded my position back then. And then in this recent turn, I didn't buy it. The low was back in 2015, 2016. So I missed the very low. But the actual, if you look at the gold to S&P 500 ratio, the low for like S&P 500 price in gold, that actually bottomed in 2018 and started turning up. So it managed to kind of catch that low, but not the actual absolute low.
I think you made up from the late 90s to 2011. I'll forgive you for that one, Lynn.
I was young and it's a very small amount.
All right. So what about Bitcoin? What about the cryptos?
So back in 2017, I wrote, I had so many emails from people asking my thoughts on Bitcoin because that was back when it was just surging.
Yeah.
So I finally was like, okay, let me write this article. So I wrote this long article. I had a pretty neutral outlook on it. That it really comes down to the network effect and how much confidence it continues to have with people. Because even though the number of units in Bitcoin is it's not going to increase. It's a deflationary static number. Beyond 21 million, of course, it'll go up very slowly and then it'll level out. But if people lose interest in the Bitcoin network, there is a risk that it could go to zero. On the other hand, if the Bitcoin network continues to be popular and, you know, trillions of dollars of money pour into it, you could have a tenfold or a hundredfold increase in Bitcoin price. Mm-hmm. So back then, I had a pretty neutral outlook on it, it might be suitable for a small position, but that I preferred gold, silver, and for people that want that more upside potential, gold and silver miners. Right. Now that we've had 2.5 years or so, I am now more bullish on Bitcoin going forward because there's more catalysts now. There's more, now we're actually at the phase where post this shortage, we're likely to see a weaker dollar. We're likely to see more liquidity. So Bitcoin's a strong liquidity play that benefits from a lot of the same forces that are beneficial to gold and silver. And it's a form of diversification.
All right, Lynn. Well, that was one heck of a conversation. Thank you so much for your time and answering those questions. I think people are really going to understand how this whole system works a lot better so they can take and make better decisions for themselves on a moving forward basis. So for all of the viewers out there that want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
So I have lynnalden.com. That's my main website. And I have a free newsletter. And then I'm on Twitter at lynnaldencontact.
All right, Lynn, I appreciate it, and I can't wait to do it again.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.